Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here. I am so excited today. We are talking about The Poppy War by R.F. Kuang. I brought on Emma. Hi, Emma.
Hey, friends. It's Emma. Pronouns she, her, hers. Thank you, Renee. Poppy Wars. Poppy Wars, y'all.
So I powered through this trilogy in a weekend. I started reading it, I think probably because of you, Emma, probably because of Diana, Owl's Little Library. I know she loves it.
Yes.
Tiffany, read by Tiffany. I mean, everybody on the internet seems to be screaming about this book.
Yeah.
For this trilogy. So I picked it up, wasn't really sure what I was getting into. And now this is just our chance to freak out together.
Yes, absolutely. And this is a spoiler episode, right? So we just be aware if you're listening. This book is really, it's funny that you brought up Diana and Tiffany, because I feel like those are the first two people I saw it from too. And I feel like when I first joined Bookstagram on like about a year ago, this was the book. And I was like, okay, I got to read this.
So yes, like Emma said, this is going to be very spoiler heavy. So if you haven't read this trilogy, stop what you're doing. Buy it right now. We'll have links in the show notes. And I also want to give some trigger warnings too. We will likely be talking about racism, xenophobia, war, violence, rape, drug addiction, anything else you can think of, Emma. Those are most likely.
Abuse.
Genocide.
It's a very heavy book. So definitely, you know, be gentle with yourself if you have read this one or haven't read it and you're just listening to our spoiler conversation.
So let's get started. Just a quick refresher for everyone who may have read this, you know, when it first came out, at least the first book came out about 2 years ago. This is actually, the author sold this book on her 20th birthday. Can you believe how young she is?
That's amazing. Well, and I think she got her master's and PhD in history, or what is
She's
now
still
getting
working on her PhD. She has a master's and master's of philosophy, which is like the UK version of an MA in Chinese studies, and she's currently in a PhD program for East Asian lit and language. Man. Which is just
I mean, not that you need a degree to do any of this stuff, but like her studies in history is like so clear in this book. I mean, like I'm a public historian, so like I'm always like, ooh, like history. And I love how like Tiffany says in her blog, like you can read this two different ways. You can read it like for fun, like turn your brain off, well, for heavy fun, or you can read it like with all the parallels to history, and you can tell that this author did her research. It's very intense.
Yeah, and that was one of the things while I was reading, I was like, I know that this has some sort of historical, like it's based in history. Like even though it's a fantasy novel, I could tell some of this shit must be real.
yeah, definitely.
I had no idea how real so much of it was, especially book one. And we will link Tiffany, Read by Tiffany's blog, where she kind of breaks down all of the parallel events and wars that this book is based on. But the one that really struck me is the massacre at Golan Nis. It is absolutely brutal. That is one of like the bloodiest chapters I have ever read. Granted, I've never read Game of Thrones, so don't come to me.
This was definitely what I up there. I think you're right. I think this is really, and honestly, just like, I feel like, and that's the whole point of the book, right? It's like talking about war and like how terrible it is for everyone. And like, I think one of the things that really stuck with me for those pieces was when she writes about the essential comparison of the rape of Nanking, and like the things that happened to Venka were real pieces from history that happened for two women by the Japanese army. And like, you know, she does not like, she doesn't shy away from this, and it's really, really hard hitting history. But it's interesting too, because like, I've read this one article, I think Iris Chang wrote it actually, who wrote this book called The Rape of Nanking, which is a history book, who talks about like, can it be traumatizing to read these primary documents? Can it be traumatizing for historians? And like, it, like when you read stuff like this, even though this is a fantasy book, like those were real things that happened. So like, what is the trauma there? And I don't know, again, like my public historian brain is just like, whoa, like this is so heavy and real, like these are real things. But at the same time, you know, I want to like shift a little bit, Renee, because like the magic, this is a fantasy book, right?
Yeah.
Did you think of the magic?
Well, I want to bridge to that, because I also read an interview with Reading Women, which is a podcast I love. Yeah. I read their transcript. I didn't have time to listen to it. I was just skimming their transcript last night. And they did an interview with Rebecca, the author. And she said she thought, when she was going into this, she thought that this could be autobiographical, that she was going to write nonfiction and do a book about her family and her family's history. But it was so close to home, it was so traumatic for her family, that the only way she could tell this story was through fantasy. Yeah. And I think that's so interesting, how fantasy can be a vehicle for healing, for discussing trauma without discussing trauma.
Yeah, yeah.
For giving yourself some space and like one step removed from how horrific some of the experiences that her family, her personal family, has witnessed. Her grandparents were alive during the Second World War, and her father was a protester at Tiananmen Square. And so that's why her family came to the US, was because he didn't feel safe in China anymore. Again, I will link that as well in the show.
Yeah, please do. It makes me think too of like, I like selfishly want more historians to dive into fantasy. Cause like, now that you say that too, it makes me think of P. Djalali Clark. I don't know if you've read like Ring Shout or A Master of Jin, but he's also a historian. And so like in Ring Shout, it's a novella, and it's like this deep dive into KKK and how they're actual monsters. Oh. So like this weaving of like real and historical plus like fantasy elements is just so interesting to me.
That sounds awesome. Again, we'll leave a link to that. So the fantasy, you asked me about the magic.
Yeah, what did you think of the magic?
I was waiting for it. I felt like I was waiting for it for so long. Because there is magic in this world, and yet you don't see Rin, our main character, harness it until basically like accidentally in the first book, but midway through the second book is when you start to really, she starts to understand it. She's not very good at it. I thought that was really interesting. I loved seeing her fumble and kind of find her way through. It reminds me, I'm such a Marvel geek. It reminds me of Thor's journey.
Yes, yes, okay.
In the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
Where, you know, I think it's, he finally gets his final form as the God of Thunder in, what is it? Is it Infinity War or Endgame? I don't know, one of those big scene where he like shows up at the Battle of Wakanda. So it reminds me of that. Like when it matters, that's when she shows up as the Phoenix, or she channels the Phoenix. I thought that was really interesting. What I liked about her connection to the Phoenix was it wasn't benevolent.
Yes.
This is a hungry god. And that's something that, you know, for me, someone who grew up in the West with a very Christian-centered kind of philosophy, life philosophy, just the way that I was raised, like, gods aren't supposed to be selfish. Right? And so this was so interesting and really hard for me to come to terms with and kind of wrap my brain around. What did you think?
Yeah, no, that's like, I think one of my favorite things that Rebecca does in this book is every character has all of these dimensions, right? Like, and it feels so like, I know we're talking about gods here, but it feels so human. Like, and it's not just like, hey, this is a good person, or, and I guess that leads to like, you know, this is a book about an anti-hero, but like, I kind of love that. But mm-hmm. you're right, it's weird, it's strange to grasp like these all-powerful gods that aren't good, that mm-hmm. aren't giving the advice that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah,
so it's definitely kind of interesting to grapple with.
Yeah, and I think one of the big themes overall in this whole trilogy is how convoluted right versus wrong really is.
Yeah.
And we see that in conversations with Nezha and Kitai, and, you know, what constitutes a war crime, what constitutes, you know, necessary retaliation. And I think the war and strategy in this book, I never thought I would be so interested in it.
But
it's the morality around these decisions that is so gray that I found absolutely fascinating. It is, I wrote down the phrase, all-consuming darkness.
Ooh. One phrase to sum up these books. No, just kidding.
Sure, though, but it's like, just one of the most wild reading experiences. Yeah. Totally worth it. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about war and the morality around it.
Yeah. And I want to mention too, like, as you were saying that, it made me think of like not just that piece of it, but also like who has the power, right, to make these decisions. And like, people are put in positions where they can make one small decision, whether they think it's right or wrong, and thousands of people die. I mean, like, that is what's writing, like, the power is what's writing on these decisions, which, I don't know, it's like a whole other piece to like the gray morality part, especially like some of the decisions that, you know, all of our characters make where they feel like they're making the right decision, and us as readers can sit back and be like, whoa.
Excuse me. Rin?
We just like go in there and be like, hey, what are you doing?
I think I messaged Diana, Al's Little Library, on Instagram, and I was like, are we seriously fighting genocide with genocide? And she was like, yep.
Yeah. Woof. Oh my God. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go off track your question though.
No, I think it isn't off track. I think that when we talk about war, there are so many layers, and there are so many kind of tentacles of it, right? Yeah, and this book, kind of on a meta level, also has so many tentacles and so many like smaller, not even smaller, I mean, they're just as heavy and pressing and important conversations about, you know, power, duty, vengeance, loyalty, colorism. I think that was one of the things that I really appreciated is, you know, Rin is from the South. She is darker skinned. So is Atlan.
Yeah, that's how I've been pronouncing it, Atlan. But I'm probably, apologies if I'm pronouncing it wrong.
They are both from the Spear. Ethnicity, and so they're darker skinned, and Tiffany mentions this could be kind of modern day Taiwan, and there are some like Hong Kong references as well. I want to ask, and you're welcome to pass on this question, but as a Japanese American woman, what was that reading experience like, especially when it comes to how Japan is portrayed, how colorism is portrayed in this Japan is kind of portrayed by the Federation of Mugen, which is the first to strike genocide. And it is based on Japan's experience in the Second World War.
Definitely. Yeah, no, I mean, it was definitely, and I'm really lucky too. I buddy read this with a couple friends of mine. Shout out to Hillary Reed's books, and she's Chinese American, so it was really interesting having conversations like as Asian Americans, as me as a Japanese American. And you know, it's definitely like hard, but I'm really glad that it's there. I mean, these are very real, terrible things that happened. And, you know, I think Japan, I'm speaking as a Japanese American, so like, I only know, you know, that part of it through my grandparents, but like, I didn't learn any of that from them. And I know like Japan does not talk about these things. And especially with like the comfort women, especially with the atrocities that Japanese soldiers did. And, you know, I'm glad it's there, because like, we need to talk about these things. And especially from like, you know, the American piece of it is like, we see what happens when we don't talk about honest history. And like, when we don't talk about the truth. And I know this is a fantasy book, but like, you know, there are real pieces that happen. So, you know, it was hard, but I'm glad it was there. Definitely. Yeah. And just reality. Speaking as like an Asian American period, reading this is awesome. Like, it feels so good to have such an incredible, like incredibly woven, intricate, like just trilogy with Asian characters. It's just so cool. And like, I am really grateful, like as an Asian American, that like this series exists. It's just very exciting.
And as a white reader, I mean, God, we can learn so much, but also it just expands our worldview in surprising ways. Like, I wasn't expecting to go into this history of like the Sino-Chinese or the Sino-Japanese war. Like, that wasn't
something
that was ever on my radar. And so the fact that, you know, this book inspired me to do all this research on a part of the world that was not taught to me. I mean, we hardly even got American history in my, you know, public school. And I think that it speaks to like what you're saying. It speaks to, I'm reminded of Hamilton, right? You have no control over who lives, what, who dies, who tells your story. And that is kind of the central piece of all of this. And we can talk about the end if you want, and how do nations, how do these characters move on, and who's the real villain here?
Yeah, honestly, and I'm glad that you brought up the end, because I feel like the way it ended with Rin, you know, just a refresher for anyone listening, with Rin essentially committing genocide, like it made the next two books hard for me, because I do think I had to turn off my like historian brain a little, because, you know, here's this person who just killed tons and tons of people, and now we're still reading from her, like what's going on with her in Burning God. And like, I don't know, it made me think like, would I want to read, and I like, I don't, I'm hesitant to make these comparisons, but like, and I'm not comparing them as characters, but just in the sense of like historical figures who have done terrible things. Like, it made me think of like, would I want to read a main character book with like Hitler or Andrew Jackson, or like, and again, like with the understanding that, you know, this is a fictional character, they're not necessarily comparable, but it made it really hard. I mean, yeah. Like, people died, and we see like her rationale, right? Like, she thought that was the right thing to do, and like, we see why she did it. But it's like you said too, like, how do you move on from that? How do you reconcile? How do you, as a person, which we see in her journey, like in the next two books, but like, also like, how do nations move on from that? And is it even possible? Like, and I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm interested actually, Renee, to see what you think.
I mean, I think we see, I think that decision to set fire to Mugen is, and commit genocide, is wrought from trauma. And I think the only way to move on that we see in Ren is she just kind of files it away for later. I'll think about it later. It's what I needed to do because, you know, this is what a human with so much trauma feels is right. She's broken, right? And you can't make good decisions from broken places. And we see this. I mean, this is war.
And also this. That's like a perfect, like, whew, Alton's character. When you said that, when you can't make decisions from a broken place.
Yes. Yeah. He's hella broken too. I mean, they all are. And I think that's what makes them interesting and complicated. I think that in the end of the trilogy, the reader comes to realize that really at the heart of all of this is colonization and how messy it is, how immoral it is, how fucked up every part of it is. And so but the question still remains is like, how do you as a citizen of a nation or as a representative of an ethnicity, how do you combat that? How do you make peace with that? Can you? And maybe it's not, maybe I'm blaming the victim here and maybe it's more on like, don't colonize.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard too, because we see regular people later in this book, these books too. And that's really hard. We see like how war is affecting regular people and how like, you know, there's a lot of starvation across the country. And, you know, like, yeah, I think, okay, so this is like a little bit of a shift, but it makes me think of, there's this one line that like always sticks with me in this book. And it talks about how each life was an entire world constructed around them.
Woof.
And this was like all around a character's rationalization that these were just numbers, a quote necessary subtraction, because they were thinking of people as numbers. But that recognition that also every time we talk about numbers of people, there's whole worlds involved. And I really like how that this book, like it really shows that, like, these are people struggling with everyday decisions and everyday lives. And then in some cases, like not everyday decisions, but, you know, we see all of the rationale, like for better or for worse, that makes it really hard. Actually, Renee, since we mentioned him earlier, I'd love to talk to you about Alton.
Yeah.
I had a really hard time with Alton.
I am usually drawn to broken male characters. I'm usually drawn to all broken characters. I love a good unlikable character.
This book's got lots of them.
Oh yeah. Seriously, I love unlikable characters. I don't know what's wrong with me. But Alton,
I had a really hard time after he abused Rin. Like, yeah. Well, he had been pretty abusive, but like after he physically abused her,
yeah,
like that was really, really difficult to read.
I couldn't have any sympathy for him.
Mm-mm.
And I think that was, and like, and we're supposed to be rooting for him too, because he's part of the psych, and they're kind of taking on, you're this band of misfits, which I absolutely love. I mean, I feel like that was some necessary comedic relief, was this,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
land of misfit toys and Kerguelen or whatever. But I still just like couldn't, I didn't understand why Rin was so infatuated with him. And I mean, infatuated kind of in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
Did she want to be him or did she want to fuck him? I don't know.
probably both, I think. Yes. Yeah.
But also, aren't they cousins? Like, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I really struggled to connect with him.
Yeah. And it's hard too, because like we see how hard his life was and his struggle with opium addiction. And I mean, that's the thing is like, you know, we didn't even bring up opium yet, but like what a huge thread throughout these, all three of these books.
Yeah. The fact that, you know, so much of the wealth in certain parts of the country is due to illegal opium trafficking. It's like, shit, that is so modern and yet
rooted
in history again.
Yeah. And not only that, but like just what do you think about like the piece about, you know, like, to reach the gods, you use drugs.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. Like,
you didn't have to, but it was like the easiest opening.
Yeah. Yeah. True. Thank you.
You can meditate or use drugs.
Yeah. And like, especially like, also talk about like comedic relief. Like, I know he's a really serious character, but like, Jiang is like one of my favorite.
I love him.
Actually,
so
yeah,
much.
We were talking about characters we don't like, but maybe we should mention characters because there are a couple of characters I do like. So
yeah, Jiang, absolutely. I love Venka too. I mean, you already mentioned her, yeah, and she's kind of the stand-in for the comfort woman historical story, but I just was so drawn to her. The pirate queen, Moag,
yes.
Also obsessed with her.
Yes. Definitely. Yeah. Kitai, I think throughout all three, is probably my favorite character. One of my favorite characters, though.
Yeah, I again struggled because I just wanted him to make a decision. He was just so like,
yeah,
so deliberate.
Yeah.
Like, buddy, come on.
Yeah, yeah. What about Neza? What do you think of him?
Equal parts loved and hated him. I will say, like, one of the coolest scenes ever is in, I think it's in Dragon Republic, the second book, is that battle kind of in the gorge, in the river, by the, where the dragon makes his first appearance.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I really like the imagery that was used in that scene, especially. I just think that, God, I think Kwong is such an amazing writer.
Yes, yeah. And also, like, I love hearing, this is like going back a little bit, but I love hearing that you read them back to back, because I did the same thing, and I think a lot of people probably have. Like, it's really hard to just stop, and I'm very, very thankful that and grateful that I read them after all three were out.
Yes,
because like, shout out to all those of you who had to like wait for each one, because they love to end on like some serious cliffhangers.
Hell yeah. And I'm thinking now, like, there's a lot of the same kind of historical elements in Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse.
Ooh.
And I know that's going to be at least two books, maybe three. And yeah, I'm just like, shit, should I like wait till they're all done? I read the first one and now it's like, I'm going to forget it all.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to reread it.
Reread them all. I feel like for these ones though, like, I definitely needed some space from them first, but like, I think I'm ready for a reread soon, because like, I know now that we know everything, like, it would probably be a different experience reading through, especially the first one when Rin's like studying and like going to school, and like, I don't know, I really, you know, I love a good academia.
I like, was just gonna say that. I love a good boarding school trope.
I love a good, like, yep.
She hooks us in with Matt. It's like the school for special kids.
Yep.
Absolutely, like, here for it.
An orphan going to a special school. Like,
it's,
I mean, I love it. I love it.
So joyful. And then it's like, just kidding. This is the darkest shit you've ever read.
Exactly. Exactly. Actually, one of the things I want to ask you about thinking of the school is, like, I thought, you know, I think throughout these series, like, there's a lot on, you know, propaganda and extreme nationalism. So I'm like just interested to kind of hear like your thoughts on like kind of that piece of it. And I know, like, one of the main questions I had when I read this book is like, when we have schools and institutions and governments in power that are putting out major propaganda, major extreme nationalism, when someone makes individual decisions, like how Rin, you know, kind of does, like, how much responsibility, like, kind of lies on each individual, and how much responsibility lies, like, if any, on the actual government putting out the propaganda. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we saw a lot of this. I think that it's both and. We saw a lot of this, we're seeing a lot of this with, you know, kind of conservative Trumpian approaches to the pandemic, right? And that I'm not going to get the vaccine because I've understood all of this propaganda telling me that it's not going to work, or it's like government conspiracy or some shit. I don't know. And so who's at fault there, I think, is the same parallel. It's both. It's those in power who are disseminating this propaganda that is meant to kind of influence the minds of people for their personal benefit rather than kind of the good of the collective. I think it's interesting to see this in an Asian context where we understand that it is such a collective experience, especially compared to the United States, where it's such an individualistic experience. And I think that only Rebecca Kwong could have written this, having kind of seen and experienced both cultures. And so she could speak to it so beautifully, and this kind of tension of, is it the individual? Is it the collective? Is it the government? Who's in power? Who's got the power? And whose fault is it? I mean, there is no right answer there, right? Yeah. And that's what's so difficult about these, what we're experiencing and seeing now is, yeah, we all want to see Trump and Joe Rogan and these fuckers held accountable. Yes. Right?
Yes.
But there's no like clear crime, yeah, because it's so insidious and kind of so, I don't know, it's so embedded in our culture that it's difficult, yeah, to kind of say, yeah, this is the crime and this is the justice for it.
Yeah. And it takes us back to that kind of power conversation too, yeah, of like thinking about who has the power to kind of make these decisions that affect millions of lives and people dying, like deaths.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And why are, yeah, those people in power in the first place? We don't know.
Well, and that's what's so interesting. Like, it all, you know, comes back to this book is like, we see how, you know, like throughout the series, how that happens, mm-hmm, like how she becomes in power, like, mm-hmm, and how these other people, but at the same time, like they clearly had, you know, some advantages by going to Synagogue, like going to the school and knowing the people they knew. And it's just really, man. So there's so many pieces about this book that I feel like you could just like sit on and talk about, and
we
like
can have a whole podcast about it. Like,
yeah,
whole,
yeah. Like, where's show, the Poppy Wars podcast?
Right, I'm sure it exists.
PWP. Like, come on.
I know, never mind, y'all. Feminist Book Club. We're shutting down. We're just a Poppy Wars fan club from here on out. Sorry.
Every box is Poppy Wars merch. Amazing.
Well, I think on that note, we should wrap it up. I do want to ask you, have you read The Drowning Faith, which is book 2.5? It is apparently scenes from Neza's point of view.
Okay, yes, I did read this. Sorry, it took me a second. I read it after I finished all three, though.
Yeah.
But yes. Did you read it yet?
No, I just discovered, okay, that it existed last night, so I gotta go find it.
Yeah, I think it, even though it is like 2.5, like for those of you who may not have read it, in some ways I feel like it's better to read it when you're done, because like you know more, like,
yeah.
And it's on Neheza, so like, I don't know, there's some pretty major things that happen at the end with him.
Yeah, and I think I want to revisit him, because like I said, I'm really conflicted about Neza. Well, on that note, colonization is bad. Colorism is bad. Genocide is bad.
They think the truths we walk away with in this book, but everything else is very murky.
Everyone's a villain.
Everyone's a villain.
Emma, thank you so much for just geeking out about this book with me, and
thanks
for being
having
so willing.
Me. Yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you for having me. And like, yeah, for those of you listening that just want to DM us and have a conversation, like, please do, because I will end on this too. Like, this was one of the first books that I saw when I joined Bookstagram, and this is also like for me one of those books that showed me the real beauty of like Bookstagram, like Instagram booksta on Instagram. And that was because like I had so many conversations with people about this book, and it was just so awesome, like people with totally different thoughts, different perspectives, like all different places where the conversation was going. And I think it really shows the strength in this book too. It's just like the conversations you can have with this, the friendships that you can make out of it. So like, you know, a little bit sappy, but like, I do really love this series for that as well.
Yeah. And it just is testament to reading as a social experience. It totally can be if you're just in the right places, and the right places are Bookstagram, BookTok, BookTube, Feminist Book Club.
Yeah, exactly.
So where can we find you? You want to give a quick shout out to your Insta before
we
go?
Yeah. So you guys can DM me at Booked with Emma. And seriously, like, I'd love to talk to you guys about this one because, and we're only talking about the first book, really. I mean, geez, like, there's a lot going on in these.
Well, and you can find me over on the Feminist Book Club Instagram, Feminist Book Club Box, or my personal Insta, which is Belle Renee. I'm not very active there, though. Thank you so much for joining us and geeking out with us, everyone. Don't go anywhere. We hope you enjoyed this. If you like hearing us kind of discuss books like this in depth, let us know. I'm curious to know if you like this episode, if you like this style, and if you want to see more of it or listen to more of it. Emma, again, thank you so much, and we will talk again soon. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club. A well-read woman.